Hi, I'm Judy Williams, and you're listening to Drinking and Drashing, Torah with a Twist. And, oh wait, hold on, my cats are fighting.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
You know, we always talk a lot about getting listeners for this podcast, right?
We do. We are constantly looking for new listeners and new ways to get new listeners listening to the podcast.
Yeah, and I do want to say, like, we hear a lot of the time people, when they're going through really difficult times, they may have kind of lessened their listening in the podcast. They may have been able to turn away from it. And sometimes it might make us think a little like, well, if they're not listening, how could we get new listeners?
Right. I mean, I think one of the biggest ways we get new listeners is when we have a wider pool of guests, because some of our most interesting guests have been the ones who really don't overlap with our network. And are able to bring in a whole new pool of listeners.
So you're saying even if we, acting as kind of spokespeople for, I don't know, the people with a platform, were willing to hand the microphone over to a new person, say maybe an Aaron, we might get new listeners?
You know, I think that's exactly right.
Well, I think that we read something really similar in this week's portion. I mean, I know that Moses says to the Israelite people, hey, listen, and they're a little spiritually crushed. And then, you know, basically God's like, hey, you and Aaron, you got this. It's going to be good. Just work together as a team and you're going to make a really important message come through.
Yeah, I mean, this Torah portion's a little complicated. There's a lot going on. It's a big narrative. It goes in a lot of different directions, but I'm excited to get into it.
I'm pretty sure that we've got a good teammate to come pick up the mic with us this week.
Let's go.
To Drinking and Drashing, Torah with a Twist. We're super excited to be in our second parsha of the Book of Shemot. That's the Book of Exodus. Last week, we were a little confused because we had the Book of Shemot and Parshat Shemot, and those were the same things except different, right? And there were a lot of names. And this week, we are actually kind of thick in the drama of it. And there's a lot of things that are happening in this arc of redemption or arc to redemption of a tale of slavery and crying out and God hearing, except not for a while. And there's plagues and there's going and talking to people and there's a let my people go. And wait a minute, it's not my job to do the distilled Parsha summary. I know that Gabe would be really upset if he thought I was just jumping in. So I'm going to take a step back and say, I'm really excited to be with everyone today for Parshat Va'era. That's not Va'era, which is in Genesis, but Parsha Va'era, which happens to be in Exodus this week. While this parsha has many twists and turns, and honestly, some difficult corners that we find ourselves in, I feel really blessed this week to have a guest who's going to help us walk through it. Even though the conversation might be a little tricky at times, I'm really stoked to just dig deep. So this week, we are so thrilled to have Judy Williams join us. Judy is a Black Jew, longtime educator, and native New Yorker born and raised in Queens, New York City, to Grenadian parents. The majority of Judy's 13-year, that's a bar mitzvah, career in education was as a history and political science teacher in predominantly white, heavily resourced private schools. There, she experienced her presence as a Black woman as a form of protest. Through her involvement in several Jewish social justice organizations, including NYC's Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, Judy fuses her commitment to social justice, political education, and Jewish values to raise awareness around and move toward the eradication of racism within the Jewish community and beyond. Judy attends a Reform synagogue in Queens and loves singing and Torah. She attends weekly Torah study sessions and frequently collaborates with the musicians at a Reform synagogue in Manhattan. Most importantly, she is the proud and mildly allergic mom of sibling Black cats, Winston and Salem, both of whom she has raised to be proud of their Blackness. Judy, I am so thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome to Drinking and Drashing, Torah with a Twist.
Thank you for having me. This is really exciting and a ton of fun. I'm already having fun. Nothing's even happened yet.
I'm thrilled. As somebody who can say that that is really his experience on a daily basis in this particular apartment and sometimes with this podcast, Gabe Snyder, how's it going, buddy?
I'm doing great. I loved everything about that bio.
Fantastic. Especially the cats. I know, Giba is a huge cat lover.
You know, cat people are good people. They understand boundaries.
Yes. Consent matters. Yeah, cats. Exactly. Good.
Incredible. It's amazing what we can learn from our pets. Speaking of non-pet owners, but still pet lovers, executive producer Eden Waldman, what's going on, buddy? We're super stoked to have you on the show tonight.
I'm so excited to be here. This is, I'm with Gabe. That bio was great. I'm really excited to get to know Judy better. And this is fantastic. I mean, I will also add, though, that in terms of not a pet owner, but a pet lover, not in the too distant future, I will say. That might change.
Ooh, what our listeners cannot see is that every other person on this call just had a yay face and a wow face, and we're rooting for that face. So for everybody listening in, we're not going to be talking about pets this entire episode, but for right now, we hope you enjoyed it because we're about to get started for something completely different.
All that talk of pets in the introduction, I should say animals do appear in this Torah portion in kind of a less fun way. So anyway, let's get to it. God appears to Moses and kind of does a reintroduction. I am the Eternal who appeared to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob with one name, but now I have this other name. Also, we have a covenant, so I need to help the Israelites out because they are suffering. So go tell them all of that. I'll lead them out of Egypt to the Promised Land and I'll take them as my people and I'll be their God. Good? Good. So Moses relays the message to the Israelites, but they didn't want to listen because their spirits were broken. So God tells Moses to just go to Pharaoh and do the whole let my people go thing. Moses is a bit nervous about this because the Israelites wouldn't listen to him, and also he has a bit of a speech impediment, so God tells Aaron to help him out. Then we get a genealogy. There's a lot of names, so we won't worry about that right now. After the genealogy, we get the whole beginning of the story again, because you might have forgotten it while trying to read all of those names. Basically, Moses doesn't want to do the talking, so God will talk to Moses, Moses will talk to Aaron, Aaron will talk to Pharaoh. Sounds like kind of a convoluted system, but if it works, great. Wait. God is going to harden Pharaoh's heart? Then why are we doing all of this in the first place? Don't worry about it. God tells Moses and Aaron that once Pharaoh refuses, there will be a bunch of plagues. Oh, by the way, Moses is 80 years old and Aaron is 83. Next, God teaches Aaron how to turn his staff into a snake. Cool. So they go to Pharaoh and do the snake thing to show God's power, but Pharaoh's magicians are somehow able to do the same trick. Don't worry though, Aaron's snake eats their snakes, but still, Pharaoh won't listen. Plague time? Plague time. We start off with blood. God tells Moses to tell Aaron to hold his staff over the water and it will turn to blood. Gross. All the water in Egypt is now blood, so the people can't drink and all of the fish die, but somehow the Egyptian magicians do the same thing. Alright then, 1 week later, frogs. God has Moses ask Pharaoh to let the people go. He refuses, and God tells Moses to tell Aaron to once again lift his staff over the water to summon frogs. Side note, God says that there will be frogs, plural, but then the actual plague happens, it's in the singular. So anyway, the plague of frog happens, but somehow the Egyptian magicians also manage to pull a frog out of a hat, or something like that. Pharaoh makes a deal that he'll let the people worship God if they'll just get rid of the frogs, but God is kind of one of those be careful what you wish for genies, because instead of all the frogs just going back into the Nile, they all die, causing a big mess and a terrible smell. Again, gross. What's next? Lice, and my head is already itchy. God tells Moses to tell Aaron to strike the earth with his staff, and look at that, creepy crawly vermin all over the people and animals. Finally, the Egyptian magicians are not able to replicate this one. Take that, Pharaoh. Next, flies, swarms of insects invade Egyptians' homes and palaces, but not the Israelites. Nice. Pharaoh makes another deal to get rid of the insects, but still no freedom. So, cattle disease, actually all livestock, but not the Israelites' animals. Were they Pfizer or Moderna? All right, that didn't work. Next up, boils. Gross. Pharaoh's still not budging, though. So, hail. But this time, they give Pharaoh a warning to get the animals and their stuff inside first. That's nice of them. Some people didn't listen, though, and fiery hail rained down and destroyed their stuff and animals and people, but not the Israelites. Finally, Pharaoh relents and promises to let them go if they just stop the plagues, but once the plagues stop, he changes his mind. We end our portion there, Egypt in ruins, Pharaoh's heart hardened, and the people still enslaved. And that's Parashat Va'era.
Wow. That was... Wow. that was... that was actually funny. And it's like not at all a funny tour portion. I love that you mentioned their ages, the 80 and the 83. We often talk about, I don't know, whenever I think about age, I think about ageism. And we often talk about organizing and protesting and freedom. We talk about it in terms of youth. We need the young people. They're the ones that are going to get us out of bondage. They're the next generation. They're the ones that are going to fix everything. And in this situation, we have Moses and Aaron, who are definitely not youth. And it's nice to see that we have these two, you know, seniors doing this work, and that we end up looking to these seniors now as examples of what to do and, you know, what it looks like to speak truth to power when you're afraid.
I would say even though that, like, within our Torah portions, right, we still have that generational kind of flex almost, right? Like that kind of pushback. We have like that, hey, boomer mentality, I would argue sometimes, against Aaron and Moses, of Moses saying like, well, why should they even listen to me? You know, and God going like, no, they'll listen. And sometimes Moses and Aaron make it worse. They don't mean to, they're well-meaning. But sometimes it's not always so easy. And I think that part of that is God knows that, like, starting off in leadership, it's not always going to work the first time around.
Yeah. And I think too, when we think about leadership, I think we often think it's got to be perfect, right? Like Martin Luther King, for example, just came out of the womb knowing how to give these amazing speeches, right? Like, he just showed up in Atlanta, right? Like, just was born one day and there he is, right? Like, just talking about the mountaintop and having dreams and stuff. And it was like, wow, this must be in his DNA. And really, that's, I'm sure, not the situation, right? We often, like, we romanticize people who we see as leaders. And I think what's great about Moses and Aaron is we know that they're not at all romanticized in this story, and yet they got the job done.
You know, we hear in our prophetic texts that, you know, the ultimate redemption comes when the old will dream dreams and the youth see visions, that there's kind of this, there's this idea that we all have to kind of work together, but there is a piece of it that's about age, that's about experience, that's about lived experience, that kind of, you need to have both, right? You need to have the kind of hope and vision and kind of almost recklessness of youth, but you also need to have that wisdom that comes with age. You need to have that ability to, you know, learn from past experience. So it's a little bit of a balancing act. And, you know, that quote, the old will dream dreams and the youth shall see visions, that's from the book of Joel, but it's incredibly relevant to this Torah portion, right? That, like, we need to be able to all work together in our community to kind of bring about redemption, that Moses needs Aaron and they need to have the people behind them. And at the beginning of this portion, they're really not. So I'm really excited to dive into this Torah portion a little more. I'm really excited to hear about your work and your background and kind of what you're doing with all of this. So let's get to that.
Judy, we were just listening to you speak a little bit about leadership and presence. And I wanted to note, you wrote something really beautiful in your biography about this idea of presence as a form of protest. And you are really focusing a lot on work to help not only the Jewish community, but hopefully even outside the Jewish community, but certainly within the Jewish community, become anti-racist or start walking that line towards anti-racism as best we can. And I would love to know what inspired you to get into that work, and also how presence can truly be a form of meaningful protest.
Yeah, wow. What got me into this is a really great question. I wish there were one moment that I could point to and say this was the moment where I decided I was going to start doing this work. I think I just kind of fell into it. It's a series of experiences that I had where it was like, I think this is a moment where I need to speak up, or this is a moment where someone needs me to say something because this thing is going to keep going on if no one says anything. For sure, by the time I got to teaching in some of these schools, it was like a no-brainer. I think I have a friend, one school that I worked in, I was their first Black teacher in the history of the school. The school was about 82 years old at the time. And so a friend I made there, her name is Joelle. Hey, Joelle. She said, I had the Jackie Robinson experience at that school. And I really did. Like, they would say and do things that I just found really strange, right? So I won't get into that. Don't want to disparage the school. But it was definitely an experience. And I ended up speaking out on behalf of a lot of these students, or teaching them how to develop their own voice so that I wouldn't always have to speak for them. I was developing Moses, a bunch of Moseses, really, so that they didn't have to use Aaron all the time, if that makes any sense. You know, so we would have students whose teach, like a teacher would stick a pencil in this girl's hair and say, wow, the pencil doesn't move. Look at that. Right. And it's like, Miss Williams, what do I say? It's like, well, let's walk through some options of what you can say. And so it became, my leadership started to look more like political education and not so much the person in the streets, the person who's like making signs. I'm the one in the background who's trying to teach people how to speak for themselves, how to organize their thoughts, how to organize themselves, you know, move forward on their own. I'm trying to have them leave the nest. For sure, just by the function of me being Black, I think I just kind of, and acknowledging the fact that I'm Black and knowing that I don't live in a colorblind society, as a lot of people would like to think that they do, I don't have that luxury. And so I'm very aware of when people would do things like interview me when they meet me for the first time. So it's not like, you know, hey, nice to meet you. It's, you know, hey, nice to meet you. Where'd you go to school? Did you graduate? What do you do for a living? Did you go to grad school? Where'd you go to grad school? Did you actually graduate from grad school? Right. Like, I get all of these interview type questions. And so my goal is to have people feel empowered enough to, one, say, I don't want to answer those questions without being rude and saying, I'm not answering those questions, but to say I'm not answering those questions and make people kind of think about why they're asking those questions in the first place. So I would say, you know, just my lived experience is what brought me into this, and my interest in forcing people to ask themselves questions when they're saying things that are harmful or could be harmful.
You know, those experiences that you're talking about, those experiences of being othered or just generally not welcomed into a predominantly white community, resonate not only in, you know, those secular school spaces, but also in Jewish spaces. We hear a lot of stories of some pretty terrible behavior in Jewish spaces where people aren't really welcomed into a community. I'm wondering if you could speak to the ways in which that's the same and the ways in which that's different. And the reason I ask this question is that in this week's Torah portion, you know, we have Moses, who is rejected not only by Pharaoh, but also by his own people, right? Also by the Israelites. The Israelites look at him and say, like, they say our spirits are crushed, but they push him aside. And between that experience and the experience with Pharaoh, he's unwilling to speak up. He needs Aaron to speak for him. So I'm curious about if you see yourself in kind of a Moses role. I know you talked about kind of seeing yourself in an Aaron role. Where are you feeling yourself in this week's Torah portion?
I'm definitely feeling myself as Moses. One of the lines, and I've had this highlighted forever in my scripture Torah, Moses appealed to the Lord saying, "See, I'm of impeded speech. How then should Pharaoh heed me?" And I know that I have these moments where I can be a little bit too honest. And I think that that can sometimes undermine what it is that I'm trying to do. So I'm always trying to be really careful, trying to balance, like, well, how much should I say? And how much should I, what's important that I say openly, even though it may make folks uncomfortable? And what's okay to not say out loud? Sometimes I have to be careful that the things I say, that I'm not censoring myself because I'm afraid, and instead I'm censoring myself because what I could say could harm someone. I'm not sure if that makes any sense. Censorship in and of itself is really dangerous, right? So when you see something happening and it needs to be said, sometimes in the process of trying to say something the right way, the person that's causing the harm doesn't receive it because they haven't actually experienced what it is that you're trying to tell them, right? Like, I'm trying to say that was just a racist thing that you just did. And you heard it as, oh, see, they think I'm a good person and that it's okay that I did that. And I just have work that I need to do, when really it's what you just said was really harmful and I'd like you to stop. So it's a balance for me, right? Like, who will listen to me and when? What should I say and what shouldn't I say? I often feel that way, especially in Jewish spaces. So I will say this, I'm a Jew by choice. And I'm also Black, as I mentioned, as you're aware, and as I mentioned in my, you mentioned in my bio. Often when I talk about what's happening in the Jewish community to Black people in particular, Black Jews in particular, I can be dismissed or questioned, right? Like my Jewishness is questioned. And I see myself in Moses in that way, or in the sense that I think the reason the Israelites really didn't accept Moses as their leader in the moment is because they don't know him, right? Like, you were just in the palace. Like, you don't get to just come out here and decide now that you're good enough to lead us, right? And so it's like, who are you? You're this Jew, allegedly. Are you a reformed Jew? Is that even like a real conversion process? Or was it Orthodox? And even then, we're not sure. Who was your Orthodox rabbi? Are they really Orthodox? Right, like all of these things are happening in people's minds. People have actually said that to me. I've had people say things to me like, I don't know which Reconstructionist or Reform rabbi converted you, but they should be ashamed of themselves, right? Just for saying, you know, this is something that I'm experiencing in real time. Like, I am in the room with you. This is what I'm experiencing. And you are telling me, because I'm a Jew by choice, that this is not something that I should be talking about that way. So yeah, definitely a Moses. That was a long answer, but definitely a Moses. And I think in all ways, right? Like, who should listen to me and why? In the Black community too, it's difficult because I'm Jewish, right? And the fact of the matter is that Jews in the United States and Black people in the United States, meaning non-Jewish Black people in the United States, have a particular historical background, right? They have a particular context that's really painful and confusing, because there was a point at which we were completely united, right? We were experiencing physical harm together, and we're just at a different place now. So it can be hard straddling those worlds, and I have to figure out what's okay to say, when and how and to whom.
So I just want to acknowledge that I really appreciate you saying that out loud. I also want to acknowledge sometimes that it's sometimes even less about what you say and more about what people hear, you know. And it's really interesting because you were very kind, Judy. You were really kind about your example that you gave of that you might look at somebody and go, oh, that thing you did was kind of racist. And people are like, oh, I'm a good person. But, you know, what I actually hear a lot of the times is the opposite, right? Like that you might say, oh, that thing that you just said or did was kind of racist. And people are like, Judy just called me racist, right? And I wanted to bring this up about things that we're afraid to talk about or things that might be a little controversial. And I'm throwing this out there because this was a huge thing that you and I spoke about when we were getting ready for this particular podcast. So I'm going to say, you've been speaking about Moses. I'm going to speak about Martin. I'm specifically going to speak about the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., because we know that this episode, and I'm shutting it out there, we know this episode is going to come out either on or around Martin Luther King Day. And Judy and I had a really important conversation that I want to just throw into the mix, which is, there is a quote that is often quoted by all the humans that Martin Luther King Jr. said, which was, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And that people have chosen to take this line to and understand it as, we should live in a colorblind society. And I, when I was speaking with Judy about this, said, well, I actually don't think that this is what this line means, because it doesn't say that people don't see the color of someone's skin. It's that they don't judge someone solely based on the color of someone's skin. And I would say that Moses and Martin were having a similar situation, which was that they were in a leadership where people were crushed by the oppression that was happening in the societies around them. And people weren't necessarily always listening to what was being said and how it was being said. And even if they were hearing it, they weren't always down or really aligning with what it meant. And so I'm throwing this to you because I know that this is a hot topic for you. And I am throwing it to you with less of a question, more of a statement for you to jump on. But I will say, if you'd like, I think this also sometimes links to performative allyship versus genuine anti-racism work.
Yeah, so we did have this conversation. I struggle with Dr. King for a few reasons, but at this point, I will say mainly because of the way his words have been weaponized, often against Black people or other people of color who are speaking out against racial injustice when it's happening. This notion of, you know, the content of their character and not by the color of their skin is interesting, especially I'll say in America, because the problem is that we're unable to view the content of folks' character outside of their color. I don't know if that makes any sense, right? The content of your character becomes your color. While they say that that's not what's happening, it is actually what's happening, right? So they'll say, I don't see color. And yet, it'll be something like, I'll give you an example, right? When we want, when Jewish organizations create opportunities for Jews of color, they will say things like, we're glad, so glad to give you this grant. Can you have someone from your group say something about how much this money that we've given means to them? It's like, well, if this is about the content of our character and that's why you're giving us this money to do this work, why do you need us to show our black and brown faces and tell you how happy and grateful we are for this thing that you've given us, right? Like, what is it that you're, what that we're saying here, right? The other piece with Dr. King that I find interesting is, in the moment when he was alive, I mean, he was killed for a reason, right? He was actually seen as someone who was incredibly dangerous. And so I said this to you, and we talked about this when we talked on the phone, right? When you are, when the options are in folks' minds, Malcolm X, right, who is being very open and very clear and very blatant about what he sees as problems. And I'm talking about post-Mecca Malcolm X, not Nation of Islam Malcolm X. And Martin Luther King, right, who's, you know, wearing the fancy suits, and he's from, you know, Atlanta, and he speaks like this, and he, right, like he's got all these fancy words, and he's not trying to be violent or doesn't sound violent. You know, the best option probably is, if you're a white person at that time, let's go with Dr. King. And I think we've taken and we've washed away the fact that this was a person who was followed by the FBI, who was who had death threats made on upon him many times and ended up dead, right? And so to me, it's disingenuous, and it's actually really causes me a lot of rage when I hear people talk about Dr. King in that way and try to make him into a Hallmark card. Like, you know, it's like the Martin Luther King card. Like, what about Dr. King? What would Dr. King say? I'm like, well, I don't know. You killed him, right? Like, oh, I like him, so I don't know. So I struggle with that. And, you know, no disrespect to Dr. King. He's done a lot for Black people. And it's problematic because I would say that the things that he had to say and the ways in which he said it, which I think were, I think now are more palatable, are the reasons why I think we're a little, things have been slow. We're not moving in the at the speed and the direction that I would like us to. Because it's easy to fall back on Dr. King and say, why are you seeing me as a white person, or why are you seeing me as insert race person? Dr. King would not like that. I don't know if I'm making sense.
I think you're making a lot of sense. And, you know, one of the things that's always struck me about the I Have a Dream speech, you know, that most famous speech by far, one of the things that's always struck me about it is that it's inherently prophetic. Right? That there's this idea that he says, I have a dream that one day this will happen. And to me, that rings straight out of Isaiah or Ezekiel, or I talked about Joel earlier, of one day nation will not lift up sword against nation. One day the word of God will come out of Jerusalem. One day righteousness will stream out like water and justice like a mighty stream. All of these things. And so this is actually one of the things that I think specifically Reform Judaism, one of the ways in which Reform Judaism, I think, actually has a lot in common with particularly American Black Protestantism, is this emphasis on the prophetic texts and the prophetic works as not only a one day this will happen, but we need to work so that one day this can happen. That's something that I see really clearly, is this using the prophetic texts not as a, oh, well, I hope one day I'll get to see this, but as a, this is my goal that I want to see in my lifetime, justice and righteousness and action to those ends. Amanda pointed out to me that one of my favorite verses of Torah occurs in this Torah portion. It's the first verse of chapter 7 of Exodus, where God says to Moses, I'm going to place you in the role of God to Pharaoh. I'm going to make you God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron is going to be your prophet. So to me, this is a very clear example of a time when we see that any one of us can be prophetic. Any one of us has that power to take on a prophetic role. So I'm curious where you see that balance of like the, I have a dream that one day this will happen. We're not there yet, but one day we're working toward that end. and taking that on personally. I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to take on the mantle of that work toward that justice and that righteousness. How do you hold that? You know, I know you said you felt like a Moses in this portion, but how would you take on the role of Aaron there? How do you react to that?
Ooh, I just insert something here really quickly, and that is the I Have a Dream speech. Here's what's interesting about it is that entire protest, that entire meeting on the Washington Mall was actually about labor organizing. It had nothing to do with race per se, right? It was about unions and labor organizing. And somehow we've taken that speech and turned it into something that we should be looking to as prophecy, right? Like, this is what Dr. King said. As far as, oh my gosh, as far as being Aaron, it's really hard. I think the thing about being a voice for people, because of course there are moments where people just can't say things for themselves, right? Or, you know, in my narcissism, it's like, I think I can say this better than anyone else could, so I'm going to be the one to say it. It's actually pretty exhausting, and I rely really heavily on Torah, on Musar, for instance, to stay afloat. It can be very draining, because what ends up happening is, you know, I'm joking about the narcissism, but it really leaves you open to getting beat up, right? Like, not so much physically, but, you know, and in some cases for activists who are in the streets, right, physically, but, you know, emotionally, mentally, it can be really painful to have people telling you how incorrect you are about what you're saying. I will say the thing that can be most demoralizing is when people who are not of color tell you that something is not racist. Right? So it's like, that was racist. No, it's not. It seems like they were just asking. It's like, no, well, I'm telling you, right, as somebody who knows, like, right, like, I don't think you're in a position to say what's racist and what isn't, because, like, you know, I'm telling you as the recipient of said racism that was racist. That can be really painful. Does that answer your question, Gabe?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's important to be able to say, here's a time where I'm Aaron and I'm able to step up and I'm able to speak, maybe on behalf of those who cannot speak. And sometimes when it's time to be Moses and to, you know, have the ideas, but not necessarily be the one at the microphone. And sometimes when you say, you know what, I can't be in the room. Sometimes you have those conversations of either for myself or because it's not appropriate for me to speak up right now. So in all of those cases, I think it's really important to be able to identify where you are on that, you know, eternal spectrum of priest, prophet, and, you know, ally, or, you know, silent background character.
You know, the thing about Aaron, I don't think people are, I think about this a lot because Moses is my homeboy. We often don't think about what it meant for Aaron to be the person that was speaking on behalf of Moses, right? Like, what was it? I wonder what it was like when he got back to the rest of the group. Like, how were people responding to him as the one who was doing the talking? Like, how was he seeing himself? We know later on that Aaron is going to be like, well, what about me? Right? Like, I was doing this. And Miriam's like, yeah, what about me? Right? We know what's going to happen there. But I often wonder how Aaron was received once his role was over, right? Were people jealous? Was it like, why does he get to talk? How come they picked him? What about me? I do wonder on a practical level what the everyday felt like for him, knowing that he'd be tapped at any moment to say something once God had something to say.
So I think generally we get that much further down the line when we deal with Aaron's response in Shemini, which is just silence. But you do bring us to a really important point, which is that sometimes when you are the mouthpiece, or at least when somebody gives you the opportunity to hold a microphone, for example, like a podcast, if you had the ability to share a message, Judy, if you wanted people to know something or do something after listening to this particular episode, what would that message be?
I think people need to be really honest with themselves. I would love for them to kind of look inward and figure out really what are they doing and why are they doing the things that they're doing, right? Are you doing it because you sincerely care? Are you doing this because you really feel like you have a stake in anti-racism work, right? If one person isn't free, like, no one is free, right? If that's what you really believe, then great. If you're doing it because it makes you feel good about yourself, for people to say, did you see what Gabe did? Gabe was marching during the George Floyd protests. Gabe was doing, insert whatever the case may be, right? If that's what's happening for you, then maybe make teshuvah, right? Like, think really hard about what you're doing and who it's for. Because I will say that when you're not doing it for the right reasons, the effect, the result that you're looking for, it doesn't come out. You may think it does, but I can tell you as a person on the black and brown end of things, it really doesn't play out the way that we think it does. And the example I gave was these, when these grantors are giving money and they want someone to tell them how great it was. That's actually really painful and it undermines what you're trying to do. We don't want your money at that point, right? We will never ask again. And then we're behind. We're all behind, right? Like, now you're not getting the ego stroke that you think you need. Now you're feeling like maybe this work isn't worth it. And it is worth it. But now we've got a chasm that was created, when really, had it been done a different way, we could have been working together and doing some really great work.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
You know, one of my favorite things to talk about in general is leadership through a Jewish lens.
Yeah, I know. You do love talking about Jewish leadership.
I like talking about it. I love teaching about it. But I have to be honest, I don't always talk about the tricky parts of leadership, right? Like, I don't always talk about the challenges or the difficulty in making decisions, or even some of the things that might, what's the word, plague us during these moments.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you need to have something to quench that anger, something to quench those bad feelings.
Would you say something to weather the storm?
This week on Midrashic Mixology, we proudly present the Fiery Hailstone. We're bringing you a non-alcoholic blended beverage to start your morning off right. This cool smoothie packs a punch with the addition of cleansing ginger and cayenne to help you ward off all those disease-based plagues. In a blender, start with 2 cups of milk of your preferred lactosity and veganitude. Shout out to the cattle disease. Add in 1 tablespoon of cocoa powder, because Aaron strikes the dust of the earth to make the lice plague happen. A pinch each of ground ginger and cayenne to ward off disease, followed by a small handful, maybe a quarter of a cup, each of frozen strawberries for blood, frozen raspberries for boils, and frozen blueberries for those hailstones. May we all see freedom soon. L'chaim.
L'chaim. I love blueberries. They are my favorite fruit, and I'm all about the hailstones.
You know, those antioxidants, you really can't get enough of them.
You know, James Baldwin, he has a title of a book. It's called The Fire Next Time. I'm with the Fiery Hailstones.
Fiery Hailstone smoothie. Nice.
All right. So on a regular basis, I try to figure out if I'm going to drink whatever Gabe makes for Midrashic Mixology. And this one's a little hard because he knows I'm not always the hugest smoothie fan, but I do love cayenne and I do love like a good blueberry, just like Judy. And so, all right, Gabe, you may have won me over on this one. We'll see. I'm excited for a breakfast start, you know, one of these days this week. Hint, not really. But actually, one of the things I'm still plagued, though, by is the passage of time. And I have to tell you, I'm a little sad to say it, but we've hit our last category, our thank yous and closing cues. And so, Judy, Gabe, Edan, in Vayera, we are told that God will redeem us in 4 ways. God will deliver us, redeem us, acquire us as God's chosen people, and bring us to the promised land. But hear us out. Right, Judy's already told us that leadership can be taken from anywhere. And so to that end, what are some ways that we could take steps towards creating our own redemption, our own redemptive arc or narrative? Hey, Gabe, let's start with you.
It might sound kind of corny or even self-serving from the co-host of a podcast, but I think the first big step toward creating liberation is to listen. I think that we spend a lot of time talking, and even when we're trying to work towards something better, even when we're doing the right thing, you know, I was jokingly called out for some performative activism earlier. Thank you, Judy. And I really think that it would benefit all of us if we spent a little bit less time talking and a little bit more time listening to those around us, to those really affected by the issues we need to address or that we want to address, and really to those people who are either, the dreamers or the seers, whether they're old or young, just to go back to that earlier part of the conversation, we need to listen to those around us.
Judy, I am really curious as to your thoughts on this, and I have my own, but I want to hear you first so that I can jump on after.
I think as a person of color, a particularly Black person, I think joy is really important. I think we focus so much on what's hard. And I said before, right, it can just be so demoralizing to get beat up all the time and to see things moving really slowly. I think sometimes just having a sense of joy and just thinking about the things that are going well, all the things that there are to be proud of, I think it can be the thing that, you know, keeps you moving.
I love you speaking about joy, especially as of the recording of this podcast, I have lots of joy because I welcomed a new family member into the world today. So hopefully she will enter into a better world every day that we're working to create. Edan, speaking of creation, what do you think about creating our own redemption?
I don't know what you're implying regarding me and creation, but I find that building community and positivity and a source of positivity is to really start from within. And I think that you need a solid foundation to build outwards and upwards. I think that everybody can always spend a little bit of time working on themselves. And I think that if we can bring ourselves to a place of self-love and self-actualization and whatnot, I think then we could really then go outwards with each other and really start to build that foundation and then, you know, build everything from there.
Okay, so I'm torn on my answer for creating our own redemption arcs. And so I'm going to put it out there. I always love this idea of doing one of two things when we realize that either we don't know something or when we realize that we were wrong or when we realize that something could be changed. One is to acknowledge and applaud, right? To be able to acknowledge that something needs to be changed and applaud the efforts that are going to be taken to change it. One is to acknowledge and amend, right? Which is to acknowledge something is totally not okay and then to make amends or to make a change. So I'm going to say this truly, right? I'm not an expert in this material. And we asked Judy on this podcast to do a lot of labor tonight, a lot of emotional labor, a lot of personal and public labor. And I like want to throw that out, right? I want to acknowledge that. And one of the reasons that we did that was we were really interested in talking to someone who had expertise in anti-racism, anti-slavery work, which is something that we need to learn more about. But here's the deal. I am a white woman. Gabe is a white man. Edan is a white man. We are Jewish clergy who are working on building up resources and relationships so that we can better serve our communities and do better so that we can lift some of this weight on our own and not always look to Jews of color to always handle the heavy lifting of these conversations. And I think that's important. I think acknowledging when we're wrong or acknowledging how we could do better is one of the first ways that we actually can move towards that redemption. I've always struggled a lot with this idea of, is there a place between oppressor being the ones doing the oppression or being the ones who are oppressed? And I think that it's a difficult space for people to occupy or to find. And I think that we have a role in doing that. And I think that all of us can do a little bit better about speaking truth to power, as Judy said earlier, or looking to the experts, but then supporting them in their speaking truth to power. I think that when people hand you a microphone, knowing when to amplify your voice or knowing when to hand it over is really important. And it's not an easy thing to learn. It's something that really, really matters. And you have to be in conversation with the experts so that you can learn, but then you have to be willing to go and do more research and more heavy lifting on your own. And these are the ways that like I learn is by getting into conversation with people who know so much more than I do. And so, Judy, if people want to get into conversation with you or if they want to learn more about the topics we've been speaking about today, how can they best find or follow you or maybe find a new resource that they can explore themselves?
Yeah, they can just send me an email at judy.m.williams@gmail.com. It's J-U-D-I. Always happy to connect with folks and share resources. And, you know, again, as the Aaron, trying to get people to be able to speak for themselves and do their own work after a while.
There is no I in team, but there is one in Judy. Judy, I have to tell you, truly, I so, so appreciate your time and energy and reflection and humor and candor with us tonight. It was really kind of you to spend this time with us and really to take this difficult portion, or I think a difficult portion, and try to connect it to your life and your experience and share that with us so openly and beautifully from the heart. And so I want to say thank you so much for joining us tonight on Drinking and Drashing. Thank you so much to Gabe for creating a delicious smoothie for Judy and I guess for me to try. I appreciate you. It's fine. Thank you to Edan for always making sure that we get a recording right, even when we have 8 million technology glitches in one episode. Thank you to Mike for editing our episodes so that they come out beautifully and that you wouldn't even know that there were 8 million tech glitches unless I said them right now. And thank you, as always, to our listeners for being here. We love you. Stay tuned for our conclusion coming at you soon.
Thanks for having me. This was so much fun.
Gabe, this is a little embarrassing for me to admit, but I find myself sometimes at a loss in these really difficult conversations about realistically how I can do better as a clergy person at making sure that every voice is uplifted, especially when I feel like I don't always know what I'm talking about. You know, in our last episode, Jason Plotkin said, hey, clergy should really make sure that we have better resources to help serve our Jews of color in our communities. And Jason also said, look to the experts. And I have to tell you, I'm so grateful to Judy for everything she did in this episode. And I'm also aware that I don't always want to lean extra hard on Jews of color to pick up the heavy lifting of making sure that I understand their lived experience when really I need to do a lot of the work myself.
It's a really difficult balance because you don't want to force any emotional labor or any hardship on oppressed populations or on people who might need our help. But at the same time, we don't want to speak for those people, and we don't want to speak over them, certainly. So it's difficult sometimes to figure out ways to best advocate and best support and best platform those who are really doing the work.
Right. And so I want to draw your attention back, or I want to draw our listeners' attention back to that Exodus 7:1, you know, that God replied to Moses, see, I place you in the role of God to Pharaoh with your brother Aaron as your prophet. They're a team. And I have to be real honest. I don't see myself as a God to anyone. I struggle sometimes even with this idea of being a prophet, but I do believe that when we speak, that words matter. They have weight and people listen.
You know, and I do want to point out that God is on that team. And that's like a really big theological statement, and we don't need to get into that right now. But there's something to be said for this idea that it's not just Moses and Aaron. There's a greater force behind all of this. So whether it's God or a concept of justice or your community behind you, we want you to know, as our listeners, that we really want to support you. And remember, we're also always willing to do the work. So if there's a voice that you want to hear, get in touch with us. You can find us at drinkinganddrashing.com and at a plethora of social media sites. So with that, as always, l'chaim.
L'chaim.
I'm Judy Williams, and you're listening to Drinking and Drashing Torah with a Twist. And Moses is my homeboy.